Yes, May I, by Kevin Ayers and the whole world, which included Lowell Coxall. May I, he came in off the street and found a small cafe, and that could be Sebastopol, where we like our businesses small and local. Mm-hmm. And that's why Paul Fritz is here tonight. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Well, welcome. And you are involved in the CORE project.
Yes.
And which got this whole big grant going, which got us to the presentation last Friday.
Yes.
So tell us about CORE and how did you get involved in it?
The CORE project is a sort of a grassroots organization. It's people who mostly local residents and business owners in Sebastopol. And they started as a group that was trying to figure out a ways to sort of revitalize downtown Sebastopol and make it a lively, vital, thriving place. And we were talking about different ways that we could accomplish this. And so an idea we had that we moved forward with was to have a design ideas competition. So we organized a design competition and put it out literally to the world. We put it online and we got, I believe, 24 entries from around the world. And that event, we had a jury of local architects and artists and planners that came and judged the entries, and then they selected their favorites. And that happened in February of 2012. And we had
That was the standing room only, that wasn't it?
Yes, it was standing room only. You could barely move in the old Copperfields used bookstore space. We had that event, and we were completely blown away by the response. I mean, we had no idea that that many people would show up to an event like that. So it really showed that the community is interested and engaged and wants to, you know, do something with the downtown and really, you know, wants to support the downtown merchants, wants to make downtown a friendlier pedestrian environment and, you know, just a thriving, lively place. So after the design competition, you know, we're trying to think of what could our next step be. And last summer we held several kind of informational sessions on the general plan. You know, the city is going through or talking about going through a general plan update. They haven't had the funding to actually go through with a full general plan update, but they have been doing some background research. They actually contracted with a group of students from Sonoma State, a class for the past year. So last summer we had several workshops or information sessions to inform people what was happening with the general plan and what the general plan is. And then we were also made aware of this grant opportunity from the American Institute of Architects. And so last fall, we worked on our grant application, which we submitted in, I believe, November. And then in December, we were informed that we were awarded, in fact, the grant, one of, I think, seven communities across the country.
Well, that is phenomenal in and of itself.
Yes, that was very exciting. And they, you know, I think that they just saw that, you know, some of the things that had been happening with, you know, the CORE project and the work that the Sonoma State students were doing and just the interest in the community and things that were happening, it seemed like this is a good time for them to come and provide us with this service. So
what type of other towns won, just to get a feel for?
To be honest, I don't know, but I know they have in the past, they range from communities smaller than Sebastopol to, you know, I know they've done one in Austin and I think maybe Philadelphia and larger community, you know, big cities, you know, obviously it's a different scale and what happens, but they've actually done two previous ones in Sonoma County, one in Windsor and one in Santa Rosa most recently. And that was the Santa Rosa Southeast Greenway project, which is the old Highway 12 right-of-way between Farmers Lane and Summerfield Road. So they were here, I believe, 2 years ago to talk about that and provide some input and suggestions on how to move forward with that. And there's still a group that is actively trying to make that happen, you know, based upon, you know, this SDAT grant sort of started that whole process. So we're hoping in 2 years we'll be, you know, a little bit further down the road as well.
Interesting. Yeah, we can talk about money in a bit and how it all happens. Yeah. And yourself, what's your background? What brought you into this?
So I'm an architect. I'm very interested in urban design and planning. So I knew some people that were involved with the CORE project and was invited to participate. And it's been a really exciting experience. It's a great group of people. We have really gelled well as a committee. You know, we're just very balanced. Everyone carries their weight. And we all have different areas of expertise that, you know, just really complement each other well. So it's been a fabulous experience working with all of them.
Oh, fabulous. And yeah. Obviously it has been successful.
So far.
Yeah. Well, let's go and just hear the first segment.
Sure.
And this is really the intros and thank yous and a bit of the history of the project. This is the introduction to the Sustainable Design Assessment Team's presentation last week at the Community Church in Sebastopol.
My name is Paul Fritz. I am a local architect, and I'm on the steering committee for Sebastopol Connect SDAT. And I'd like to thank our sponsors. These are local people who have contributed either monetarily or in kind services to the past 3 days, the event over the past 3 days. And also to our fabulous volunteer crew. We've had people the past 3 days helping set up this room, welcome people, accept donations, etc., and also helping the team prepare their thoughts and ideas and presentation for tonight. I'd also like to, speaking of donations, like to remind everyone that we are accepting donations. The way this grant works is the American Institute of Architects contributes a portion of the money to accommodate and transport the team here, but the city, local community, is required to come up with a $5,000 matching donation, and we're well on our way towards that, but we can still use some more. So if anyone feels the need to donate or the desire to donate, we'd be happy to accommodate you. A little bit just about the background. This all started with the core project design ideas competition about a year ago. Many of you probably were aware of that and are on our mailing list. And after the competition ended, we thought, well, what do we do with all these great ideas? We need to move something forward. And so we kept trying to think of next steps. And last summer, we had some meetings about the general plan update process to inform people about that, because that was an important planning thing that was coming up. And then we were made aware of this grant from the American Institute of Architects. And we thought it would be a really good opportunity for us to take some of this excitement and energy we've sensed in the community about the future of Sebastopol. And so we applied for that and were awarded the grant. We found out in December, so since then we've been preparing for the past 3 days. So thanks again for coming, and I'm going to introduce Wayne Fiden, who is our team leader, and he will carry us through the rest of the evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Patrick's entirely too modest. There's an enormous amount of work the core project had to do and that the city had to do for this project, so thank you very much. We certainly couldn't have done this, Adam. So many of you here are on Wednesday. I'm not going to reintroduce the whole team, but just quickly about the process. So AIA helps underwrite the cost of this project. It's a donation from architects around the country because they really think communities should be thinking about sustainable design, should be thinking about ways they can make their downtowns more vibrant and their communities more sustainable. The team members themselves, all six of us you're going to hear from tonight, are all volunteers. We all take part in this process, both frankly because it's intellectually stimulating for us, but also because we think what you're doing here is really exciting and there's some real opportunities, and we want to come back in 10 years and see a transformed community. And I guess sort of the last comment about that is I've been to a lot of communities around the country who are sort of stuck, who don't know how to move forward. One of the reasons this is a really exciting project for us is this is a community that really can be transformed. That you have lots of community debates, which is wonderful. It's a healthy thing. Even in your worst meetings where you're at each other's throats, think of that as a good thing, not a bad thing. At least from what we've seen, your community debate is healthy. That you talk to each other instead of talking in separate rooms around people's backs. And as long as you're talking to each other, then that's what it takes to be able to move forward. We've had a series of meetings. The two AIA staff and myself were out here in January to sort of scope things out. And then the full team arrived here on, I lose track of, Tuesday night. We had focus groups on Wednesday during the day. We had a public town hall meeting at night. We did a separate focus group at the high school and heard lots of different comments. I'm sure you all can guess the sorts of things that people say to us. But it's really interesting, sort of the flavor of the community. I mean, I think some of it helped us understand what kind of community you are, but it also highlighted I think some of both the challenges for us and the opportunities going forward. Specifically, I want to talk about in concrete terms some of the things that we heard. The first is you have a strong downtown. You know, if you look at it as a downtown for the 50,000 people for whom whose service area it is, it could be stronger, and that's why we're here. If you look at a downtown for a community of 8,000 people, it's an amazing downtown, probably second to almost none for a community of 8,000 people. But nonetheless, given that you do serve a large area, there are clearly opportunities to do more. One of the questions that we asked is, tell us what's the center of downtown? Where do you hang out? And that was one of the answers, frankly, that was less satisfying than I would have liked. You know, we went to the high school, they told us they hung out at Safeway. And I know kids will be kids. I have a 17-year-old daughter, so I understand some of that. But it's still, you know, it's not a perfect sign of health. Then we heard people say they hung out at the town square, which is great, and they found some issues at the town square that were lacking. We were surprised at how few people told us they hung out in Main Street itself. Even just asking people, okay, define for me what's the center of downtown. Very few people said it's Main Street, even though ultimately you're a market town. It's, you know, it's sort of part of the defining piece. We went through meetings. I'm not going to read through this whole list. You all know the town better than I do. But we heard in 50 different ways challenges about how the town is really dominated by traffic going through downtown, that cars go through a lot of volume of traffic. People feel unsafe to cross the street. Going back to the quotes a couple of slides ago, parents and kids telling us they would not bicycle on Main Street or in some of the other streets. They were uncomfortable crossing the street. They didn't really feel like the town was as defined as it could be because they felt like we have these highways that go through downtown. And so clearly what was part of what we saw, you know, the rail trail, the bike path ending at the edge of downtown, an amazing resource, but then not really continuing through. Sometimes the lack of definition. And again, none of these things weaken the strength of the city, but they're all, in some ways, opportunities. How can you make it stronger? And then we heard, you know, other things about that, of sort of the whole debate that's been going on, I guess, for years about the Northeast plan, and that didn't go forward. And so what's the guiding vision? You have the Barlow project, I think most people on the team think is a really exciting project, but it didn't really seem like it was driven by a clear community-driven consensus for what should be there. And I think the CVS project is certainly clearly represents that there wasn't a clear consensus up front, and so that makes decision-making more difficult. I think one of the things you're going to hear from team members throughout tonight is the process is best served for everybody when we do a planning process up front and build a consensus up front, and that developers like that because they know what the rules are up front, and residents like that because they know what the rules are up front and they agree on what those are. And so that will show up in different ways when we're talking about private sector development and public sector development as the team members go. And then, you know, finally, you know, there's amazing opportunities for downtown. We think of downtown as sort of that whole core area, the traditional downtown, the Barlow, how they fit together. One of the things that planners often look at is the jargon is jobs, housing, balance. Are there about as many people who live in town as there are jobs? And if you just look at the city itself, so not West County, but just look at the city itself, you have an amazing balance. You have about 4,000 people who are employed, and you have about 4,000 jobs. The numbers are a couple years old, but so you have that balance, but of course you have all of West County, so you have a lot of traffic that's going through town to jobs east of here, and so you don't have a balance in that sense. But for us, one of the cores, what makes cities great, is as a synergy. I can go out to a suburban shopping plaza, and I go out and buy my food there, or I buy my drugs, or I buy whatever I do, and I go there, and I leave, and I go home. If I go downtown, I park my car, I go to a couple stores, I meet friends. You know, there's a synergy of those things that build on each other. And so jobs downtown are much more valuable than jobs elsewhere because they have this multiplier effect. You know, you go downtown, you don't bring your lunch, you eat. Housing downtown or housing within walking distance of downtown has the same multiplier effect. And so we're generally excited about downtowns generally, and I think that's why this whole team is here, and your downtown in particular has these amazing opportunities. So with that, Ken Buckland, who's a planner, is going to start the process, and we're going to go through our whole presentation, and then we're happy to take questions afterwards for as long as you want, but I want to start with the presentation.
Okay, that's part one of the presentation. Well, Paul, That was the intro. It was interesting what they came up with, some of the observations about Sebastopol. You were saying the team was only here a couple of days, so it was quite a whirlwind.
Yeah, they had actually, there was a sort of an advanced team that came in February. So two staff members of the American Institute of Architects who run the program for the American Institute of Architects National Office, and then the team leader, Wayne Fiden, came in February for a couple of days to do a preliminary scope of Sebastopol, and they spent about a day meeting with various groups and individuals in the community to kind of get a feel for what issues were important, and so then that helped them craft the rest of the team. So once they were here and they heard what the issues were and saw what the issues were for themselves, they went away and then, you know, picked the rest of the members to fill out the other five people that came last week. But yeah, then they were only here for 3 days last week. They got in Tuesday night, and then they were here Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So the way it worked is that Wednesday, they again had some workshops in the afternoon looking at several focused topic areas. And then we did a town hall meeting in the evening. People broke up into tables and sort of talked. He asked four or five questions and had the table kind of write down all the responses. And then we went around the room and looked at everything. And so then Thursday and Friday, the team took all that information they gathered on Wednesday and just sort of plowing through it and their own observations, going around town and kind of coming up with their recommendations, which we'll hear shortly.
Yeah, that was quite an intense program when you think of it. That's a lot to cover.
It is a lot to cover and not a lot of time. But, you know, these people have done this kind of thing or, you know, similar programs, you know, around the country. And so, and this is, you know, kind of what designers do. I mean, architects do this kind of thing a lot. You kind of have these intense design charrettes where you just spend like a day or 2 days just really focused on a problem and do a lot of sketching and observing different situations and bouncing ideas off each other and kind of whittling it down to what the core, you know, important ideas are, which is really what they did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you go to SebastopolConnect.org,
okay,
and then click on the SDAT page, there will be a link to the slideshow, and you can follow along with the slideshow that was presented last Friday that we're listening to now.
And I'm here with Paul Fritz, who is with the CORE project, and they've been overseeing and moving this whole project along, thank goodness, for the last couple of years. So I thought let's go into the second part, which is really a bit of the history of the town as a crossroads and how the general zoning is in town. So obviously that's good that they didn't just look what was here, they looked at the past.
Yes, they looked at, you know, what we have, but also how we got here. And, you know, our history is very important to people that live in Sebastopol, and so they're trying to understand the history and what brought us to the point we are and how to help us move forward. And looking to the past is always a good way to help you think about your future.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wayne, and thank you all for showing up. This has been an intensive 3 days. I appreciate the time to tell you what we've been thinking about and some of the ideas, and hopefully you can take these into the future as well too. One of the things that we like to consider when we're looking at different communities is where the history of this. Why is the city here, and how was it created, and for what reason? Well, it's at a crossroads, and you think about what was happening out there. There was a center of commerce, of social commerce, of mercantile commerce, of a situation that was based on the idea that not only the roads were there, but if you've seen the old pictures, you see the train was running down Main Street as well too, and so it became part of that fabric of what created the town, the city you know as Sebastopol. But in terms of the change over time, it has changed. It's grown. It's developed. The crossroads are still there, but more than that, what's happened is that it's developed in a different way, and we have to consider it in a different form than it was before, just as the crossroads. We have to think of the idea that there are corridors that run through, and they have different characters as they get closer to the core. And that initial little set of stores around the intersection of the main roads is now something that's larger as a core of a downtown. And when we look at that, that's what we start to think about. What is the downtown, and what are the characteristics, and how do we think about about what the future of that location is. Because right now we have this green belt of a Laguna that sets a boundary, and it's not an annexation issue that you can overcome. That's a natural resource that really defines that side of that boundary of the community. So when we look at it within that core, one of the first things we did, we start to think about, well, there's a whole series of parcels that as urban designers and planners and architects and landscape architects, we'd start to take a peek at, and we start to think about what could we make them different? How could we make them more improved in terms of their relationship to the community? And looking at even at the link that starts to work towards the Laguna or the trailer park, and even though that's outside the city boundary, that becomes an obligation to address in some way. The idea that maybe some spaces such as the parking lot could be a temporary use. Right at the end of the bike path, have some temporary activities that attract people and bring them into the downtown. When we talked to people in the community, what we saw was that right in the middle of the plaza seemed to be what we think of as the heart of the downtown. And how do we address what goes on around that plaza? I was born outside of Walnut Creek, but the fact is I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, and one of the first things I thought of was what did Princeton have? Where, when I was in eighth grade, I was selling Christmas trees in that plaza in the middle of the downtown. Here's the main street, Nassau Street, that runs, it's separated, it's surrounded by development that frames it up, and yet it has a road that runs around that square, and it's a very comfortable, it's a very safe, it's a very, very attractive location. And that's what we want to accomplish in this area. So we start to think about a couple of parcels. And I picked, first off, thought about the Whole Foods site and what happens on that location there. Here you have a parking lot that faces the plaza. You have the buildings in the strip, essentially a strip commercial center set back from the street. If we look at, start to reverse that, say, let's put our buildings up front, create that street wall across here, and put the parking behind, we have a very different kind of character and quality of the space. But, you know, that may be a little bit far-fetched because Whole Foods is making a ton of money right now. They're not necessarily going to be redeveloping it anytime soon. But there is a parcel of land that's apparently up for sale at this point, which is the lumber yard over on Petaluma on the side there. That has some interesting possibilities as well, because what we could think about, we have a line of street trees, but they're inside the property. They're essentially owned by the property owner, but they act as street trees. And we have that boundary, that link across Petaluma that could be of value in future development and how this street operates. We also have a framework in which development could occur. We could put some structure, some construction. You know, I'm showing a little bit of green on here. We have a green roof, the idea of sustainable. But there's more than just some of those design aspects to it. The reason why this line here is we're looking at potentially balconies, because when we look at a cross section, we think, all right, if we had enough development on there, we could get the kind of values, the kind of benefits to the community that we want to have. And what we do is we provide the extra floor. This is three plus stories, with the idea that there's the balconies out there at the top. It pushes back the building, so from the street line, you're not seeing a full four-story building. What you're seeing is something less. And you're probably familiar with that because you've seen that same regulation applied elsewhere within the community. With commercial space on the front to activate the location, and you know what we're showing is very little parking, and I wanted to talk to you about that because I think that's an important piece of what happens on the property. Because we've looked at, and other people have looked around the country at what different downtown projects require for parking and how that fits with residential development. And as you can see, there's a whole series of numbers. I'm going to quiz you on these ones, ask you about which town had the 1.2 parking ratio. But the fact is what happens is it comes out to about 1.1 parking spaces per residential unit in these projects. And they also locate the distance to transit, the idea you get from that location somewhere else. Well, I was looking at what's happening on this property and saying, you know, it's only 47 steps from that property over to where the transit is. I maybe have longer legs than you. I don't know how many you count. But 126 steps up to Main Street. You're connected, and think about it, it's a little bit further into the Barlow, but think about the idea that it's very walkable. You're very well connected in that location. And there's another value to the people who live in those units as well, and that's that where is their money going? It goes into something that's lost and depreciated in a vehicle, which just as a matter of fact, in terms of rule of thumb, the cost that you would pay for having a vehicle for a year could pay for a mortgage, $100,000 more in mortgage on a property. So you can think about, you start to increase your living conditions as a result of having at least one fewer cars, if not no cars. So how do we get there from here in terms of that? It's the zoning that creates the basis for development. Right now, what we're seeing in terms of your zoning is it's really based on what's on the ground. You've tried to map this out, and that's why it looks like a fairly, you know, a lot of times I tell people that zoning is like trying to read War and Peace in the original Russian. It's a tough thing to get through, but what's being done here, and typically what you see in a lot of communities, is it's pretty much what's on the ground right now. I think what you want to do instead is start to think about where it could go in the future. What can you accomplish with the zoning regulations, the real power you have? There are two aspects to the control you have on land use and development. And that's infrastructure is one, the capital programs you have, and the other is the zoning, the land use regulations that you put in place. Well, you need a general plan update for one, and that can start to lead you into the changes that are supported by zoning. But you can, in that zoning, define what you want to accomplish within those districts. Now, you have to be careful about this. You have to provide the flexibility, because what happens if you start saying, I want a butterfly museum in zoning. As a matter of fact, you won't necessarily get it because the market isn't there for that. But the fact is that what you can do is if you have enough flexibility and start to talk about what you want to accomplish with the zoning, then you can do that with the planning process you have. But there's one other aspect, and this came out as a result of looking at that Northeast Pacific plan and what happened with that. You don't have the same redevelopment authority anymore because of the way the state law went. But what you have is a potential to position your properties. Think about the specifically properties. Maybe the lumberyard is one. Maybe there's some other property that you start to think about. Maybe there are a few different properties. And how you start to base what you're doing, the pre-planning program. You're trying to define what you want as a community, what you want from the developer, and what benefits you'll provide to the developer to conform to that. So what you're trying to do is limit the problems that are associated with the entitlement process, the permitting process. Smooth it out by you as a community starting out first to define what you want to accomplish on there and what you're willing to give. If the developer comes forward and starts to do what you want, well, what benefits are they going to get from it? They want to reduce their risk as well, too, and not just pay out for all that mitigation. So the fact is you can do this in a process. And what you can do with that then is in that information is not just put it on a plan and hand it over to the planner's office or the city council, but to actually go out and market the property. Look for the developers. Look for the businesses. One of the best ways that downtown start to develop themselves in terms of improving the quality of the downtown is actually to go out and find another business that's being successful elsewhere and tell that business owner, look, we have a great downtown. We have a great site for your second business. Do you want to come in and open up a new business in that location and start to reap the benefits of being in this great town of Sevastopol? And set up your marketing brochure and say, here's what we got. You're the real estate. You may not have Ron Burgundy helping you out in terms of the marketing, but the fact is what you can do is think about this way of projecting to others and actually reaching out and being a little more active in the development process and redevelopment process once you've defined what you're willing to do as a community.
Okay, that was part two of the presentation of the ESTAT grant for the master planning, we call it. Not really. I mean, it's the pre-planning for the master planning.
Yeah, not quite a master plan yet, just some ideas. Yeah.
A lot of interesting stuff they're bringing up, even in this first go-round. And we're talking about developers, and that's the critical thing is how do you entice them in, but yet with projects that we want in Sevastopol. And it was interesting what you were, and the approach that's gone on with this.
I really think that we need to come together as a community, as Ken was saying, and figure out what do we want to have happen. You know, where do we want specific parcels to be? And then we need to work as a community, and the city, you know, city council and city staff needs to help find the developer to make that vision a reality instead of being, you know, more reactive, which I think has been what's happened in the past. You know, we don't have a real clear vision for what we want to have happen downtown, and projects get proposed and then people get all up in arms about it because it's not what they wanted. But, you know, we haven't really told people what we want. So we need to say, this is what we want to have happen here. And then we need to go find someone that can make that vision happen that provides a benefit to the community, but also obviously a benefit to the developer. You know, they're not going to come just to give us something. You know, there has to be a balance of, you know, they get something out of it, we get something out of it as well. But I think the first step is really defining that vision. And it can be for specific parcels, you know, looking at that parcel across from the plaza that Ken was talking about, the former lumberyard site, that it's a real pivotal piece, particularly now with the Barlow coming online. You know, it's, that's the link.
That is.
And what do we see that link becoming as a community, and defining that, and then go find someone to make that happen.
Well, that's it. And can that be done before, some of it be done before the master plan happens? Because obviously that costs, I mean, how much would a master plan cost for Sebastopol? $1 million?
Well, I mean, they tell you to hope, just updating the general plan is $500,000 probably. Yeah. So, you know, but we don't need to do that. We do have a zoning code that allows certain uses to happen there already, and the general plan allows certain things to happen. And we can look at that and say, well, what can we work, you know, what can we do within those confines? And then, but again, as a community, we needed to come forward and figure out what we want that to be. And then find someone to try to make that happen before, you know, another CVS comes along and then everyone's up in arms about, well, that's not what we want, but we need to tell them what we want first.
And who provides that impetus? I mean, obviously the core group can project and suggest and recommend. Is it the city itself has to pick up the politicians have to pick up the ball? Where does it go?
That would be helpful, you know. Yeah, I mean, really, getting the political will then, you know, make that happen. You know, the city council, you know, can direct staff to do, you know, certain things, and that kind of comes from a top down like that. I mean, we sort of need it from the bottom up. We need sort of a grassroots movement to tell the council, or help the council figure it out. Say, this is what we want. This is what we need. How can we make this happen? And we all need to kind of work together rather than, you know, this kind of adversarial thing that has happened in the past. And, you know, we're not always going to agree on everything. It's just human nature. There's always going to be people who have different ideas. But if we kind of come from this common place and, you know, move forward and build consensus, which is, you know, what we've been trying to do is the core project. We've been trying to keep it on this, you know, more positive plane and really involve as many people as we can and say, look, this is about all of us. It's not about our vision as members of this committee. You know, we want to hear from everyone. That's why we brought this team, and that's why we had these public workshops. We really want the most input we can get. And that's really what's going to make it successful, is if people stay involved and engaged and, you know, make it happen.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, obviously there was a wonderful turnout at the meetings, at all the meetings, I understand. So that bodes well. I know I counted how many questions and comments from the public at the end of this presentation. There's about 20 different questions were taken and of very different subjects. But really, you can see everyone was engaged in it and was very interested.
Yeah, no, it was a great turnout for a Friday night, you know. It's not the most exciting thing you would think about to do on a Friday night, go sit and listen to a meeting about planning. But people were really interested and engaged. So I'm hoping, you know, people are listening to this show, and that video presentation will be posted on the city website. We recorded it, and the whole presentation will be available on the city website, so people can go back and look at the video and continue the conversation.
Make their own comments about it as we move forward and help. Yeah. Obviously, again, we're not working in a vacuum here. This requires people to say they want this to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's it behooves us all. It's not, again, it's not the top down. It's a mixture of both we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. We need to, work together from a grassroots standpoint, but then also, we need to communicate what we want to the council, and then they need to, do what they do and work with city staff to make some of these things happen.
Exactly. Good. So should we put on another segment? This one's about the next one is about the design guidelines. Very important. This is where everything really gets set down as to people what people want,
yes,
and the basis for future development. So, sure. Very critical. Any comments on it before we start?
Not particularly. I mean, the design guidelines are one piece of all the kind of planning documents that developers have to comply with, and that was definitely an issue that came up during the CVS debate, was that our design guidelines don't really reflect accurately what we want or what we expect from developers. And so and Leslie, who will be speaking next, addresses some of that, why they're important to have design guidelines and what they can do for you. So
great, thanks. It's really been wonderful spending these last 3 days here and getting to know a fabulous community. I want to follow up on the idea of being proactive and knowing what you want, because if you can be ahead of change, you're a lot better off. And thinking too about what kinds of things that you want. There, you have design guidelines in place, and there was a desire when we were coming here to take a look at those specifically. And so we've done that, and I've written design guidelines, and the best thing you can do is have a good developer. So I think, I'm hoping your marketing program works. But the thing that's good about design guidelines is it gives you a chance to think about what you care about. There's some design guidelines that tell you what style to build everything, and there are towns that want to be Bavarian or whatever. But you guys don't want everything to look the same. So your design guidelines are a great opportunity to figure out what you care about together. And even though there are a lot of differences of opinion, it was very encouraging to hear a lot of agreement from what people were saying. So it's a frame of reference for a conversation. It's a conversation between you, the community, the property owner, the regulators at the city, as to what you want. And to have that conversation before it needs to happen, so you don't find yourself all of a sudden scrambling when a company from out of town comes and wants to put a drugstore somewhere that you're not comfortable with. So have that conversation now, and have it be a positive thing. So if you're looking for design that is going to reflect your values, here's a chance for looking at what those are, and just coming in and looking and talking to you. There's a lot of them that I think are very easy to agree on. One is a great natural setting. The oaks and the redwoods are astonishing, and you're in the middle of a forest for much of your city. Topography, there's views. You know what they all are. It's a wonderful place, and you want it to spring from your natural setting. Great oak tree. You've got a really interesting history. And a lot of communities, their history is really not legible anymore. But it's very easy to see where you came from, the apples, the warehouses, the trains. And those come with built forms, this wonderful train shed form. And those long, very simple, elegant buildings are a wonderful piece of your fabric and a main street. You've got some interesting icons. The church at the end of the street has a great vista. You've got a wonderful railroad car at a great diagonal. If you could kind of liberate it from some of the cars, it would be a wonderful representation of your town that maybe you're not even fully aware of yourselves. The main street is an irreplaceable typology. A lot of communities want this. They make it up, it looks like Disneyland. You have the real thing, and it's something I think you really need to appreciate, that fine-grained scale. And there are some little through routes that I want to talk about, too, because one of the things we heard is that Main Street isn't as connected to the town square as you'd like, but there's opportunities to do that, and some of them are kind of sneaky, but they're there. Great architectural legacy in the single-family homes, the Victorians, and the bungalows. You want to draw on that, but you also need to think about what it means to build for the future. In the end, it's about people. And one of the things that we've heard from you guys is what you love most about here isn't all the great stuff I just talked about, but it's really the people, the friendliness, the ability to talk to one another. So you want design that is going to start filling in the gaps that you have in your city, that it makes it more humane, that makes it more comfortable, more interesting, more active. So when you're looking at projects coming into your city, you know, yeah, development's scary, but if there's change coming and you're ahead of it, you know, that's what you want to look for, is what are the gaps are that you can make better. One of the things that we've heard that's such, you know, it's a favorite word, quirky, you're quirky. And I hope the guy who does these is in here tonight. It's just really, really fun. So stay quirky. Don't make everything the same. Make design guidelines that encourage the uniqueness of a place. You're artistic. Wonderful stuff to walk around and see. Sustainability is something that actually can change style of architecture. We've forgotten a lot from what people used to know. But you've got solar panels on buildings. You've got edible plants out in front of there. There's ways of shading and making entryways that are green. Those things need to be reflected in your new buildings, and you can ask people to do that. You can make places that have more seating, more activities, and that can be rolled into the design guidelines. One of the things that I want to point out are some diamonds in the rough. I'm a real fan of alleyways because I think they're a real human scale kind of space, and I don't think you've discovered all of them. I'm going to show you one that we've been playing with in Seattle in Pioneer Square, our historic district. But we've put art, lighting, white table sit-down dinners. They're great size spaces, and they don't have any cars in them. The connections is something that we've heard a lot about. There's a lot of different kinds of connections. This one goes to Barlow, and you know what? It's really pretty cool. You've got canopy, you've got a green wall with a theater. My hope for you is that, I'll talk about this in a minute, you keep that character of that street. So a couple of thoughts on your current design guidelines. Right now, there's guidelines that cover the entire city. And Main Street's different than the Barlow, is different than the single-family homes. And so I think you can tailor some of those guidelines so that you've got things that might be different at the entryway, and you can locate those. The core has an interesting line down it where it just seems to correspond with the flood zone, where you've got the industrial typology in Main Street. So as Ken was saying, the core can get bigger, but that doesn't mean it has to have homogeneous design. So increase the character of each places. Another tool that you have in design guidelines and with the zoning is to designate some streets as pedestrian priority streets. This is existing figure ground. And the red lines here show where you might want to encourage the pedestrian routes. So you can kind of decide where those pedestrian places are with the windows and the activities. And maybe you even want to go further than that. And those yellow dots are some wonderful pedestrian routes through buildings and through open spaces. There's a lot of them out here to find. In terms of process with design review, it's really helpful to have that framework for the conversation in the same way that designers design. So you start and you say, what's unique about this place? What makes it special? What are the opportunities with my project to make it even more unique and special? So what is the concept of what my program is, whether it's a hotel, which would be great, or residential? How does that program for the particular building and that site work together? And third, how do you execute that? What are the details, the materials? How do you make a quality building that your community deserves? But it's not just design guidelines. The discussion you have in creating the design guidelines are really for you, not just waiting around for the next developer, but to humanize this place your own selves. You've got great examples of it. I love this. It's a very simple shed building, but what's next to it that connects to that building makes it fabulous. It doesn't take much, you know, a chair and a non-parking spot make a great people space. You know what to do. Your public realm is what most people care about in guidelines. There's wonderful fingers of open space that run along the warehouse forms. This is one of my favorite little through routes in a little island town in Washington State. Wonderful human scale spaces that can start to weave through from Main Street to the parking behind. You've got some examples already. And they can lead you in and up, entice people. Think about the language of your street. And engineers, with all due respect to traffic engineers, we have let them design the public realm. And streets are a quarter to a third of most cities. Take it back. Don't paint it red and yellow and make it part of a place. Here's the language of a street. You know, it doesn't have to be designed for cars. Make it for people. Make it for natural systems. Use good materials. There's a little bitty 2-inch curb, so, you know, the materials going across there means that you can use the space as a pedestrian. The language of public space, you know, somebody spent a lot of work making a nice front to the restaurant, and you guys, you got the dumpster and the paint there. I don't know what that's doing, but these are cheap fixes. So design for who you are, design for the best of who you want to be for the future, and I wish you all the best of luck.
Okay, design guidelines. Interesting. It's up to our vision. It's what we want, as Lisa was saying, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she was saying that, you know, we are a quirky town, and our design guidelines need to reflect that. You know, we should really, you know, work on improving our design guidelines to encourage that identifiable, unidentifiable, you know, quirky festival.
Is there a section which says quirkiness? And
you know, I don't know how you really define that quirkiness, but I think you know, just allowing some, not requiring everything to look the same, you know, and I think she talked about that a lot. You know, we should have design guidelines by district and not just design guidelines to cover the entire city, but, you know, each district is has a different character, and we should capitalize that and improve on that character. So I think that'd be a great, a great thing to do. And actually the city council has, I believe this week, approved a subcommittee to look at improving or redeveloping the design guidelines. So as we move forward, we'll be able to hopefully implement them.
We have Robert Jacobs, from Sebastopol, Mayor of Sebastopol. Hi, Robert.
Hi there. I just wanted to call in and really just say thank you to the whole SDAT team and the CORE projects for all the work they did on this item, and really hearing the presentations so far, just really how pleased I am in seeing the way they brought together all the community's interests in presenting something that we can actually work on. Earlier in your comments around there being political will, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew that this past Tuesday, the city council approved the planning director bringing back in July a full plan for us to implement a general plan update process. And the council stated clearly that they were committed to finding the funding to make that happen, and also created a subcommittee to review our design review guidelines, which will be headed by council member John Eater and council member Patrick Slater. And I really believe it was the work of the CORE project and the SDAT team this last several months that really inspired that and made it possible for the city council to really take on the project and move this forward. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew that the work had not fallen by the wayside and really likely helped to develop the political will here in Sebastopol. So thank you.
That's great news.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Robert.
And, wonderful.
What's the tag, you know, the money tag? Obviously, you've got to approve that city council. What are we looking at this update process?
Well, the general plan update process, we don't have a money tag. In July, when the planning director brings back a plan and a process for the city to follow, a part of that will be an RFP, or request for proposals, that we will send out for contractors, potential consultants, to return a price tag. We do believe the number that has been put out there has been $500,000 to $700,000 for a full general plan update, but those are very rough numbers, definitely not confirmed. And until the planning department is able to put together an RFP, the council is able to approve that, and we send it out and get a response, we will not know the total price tag.
Okay, and that would that something like that come from the general funds? How is that normally approached?
Well, at this point, it would come from the general fund of the city. Yes.
Okay. And it was great to see a lot of the city councillors at the meetings.
Yep.
That was excellent. It was great to see the interest there.
No, we've gotten great support from the council, you know, through this whole process. So it's been really, you know, because it's been a grassroots movement, but there is a lot of political, you know, political support behind it as well. So it's been great coming from, you know, kind of both sides.
Well, I really believe that the council understands that the general plan update, the guiding document for how we will maintain the unique small town character of Sebastopol for the next 20 years, must be a priority and has to be a priority. And finding those funds and dedicating those funds and the energy of the city staff, the city elected officials, the city commissioners, to moving that effort forward now at this time is definitely key to the future development of our town.
Yeah.
Yep. Excellent. Well,
well, thank you all so much and keep up the work. And I look forward to continuing to hear your presentation online, and I'm following along with the slides, and I really appreciate this follow-up.
Great. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert Jacobs, Sebastopol. And yes, you can follow the presentation slides. Yes, if you've got your computer.
SebastopolConnect.org, and then click on the SDAT tab, and that will take you, you can see a link there that will help you follow along with the slideshow.
Good. Now, if people want to help with the core project, who should they contact? Where should they contact for more information?
Probably the best way is to send an email to info@the-core-project.org. So if you send an email to us there, we'll be able to contact you. You can let us know how you'd like to be involved. We're always looking for, you know, additional volunteers. We had a great team of volunteers that turned up to help us, you know, run this event last week. It was fantastic to see the people both just helping at the meetings, just coordinating the meetings, moving chairs, setting up the meeting rooms, taking notes during the meetings. And then during the team working sessions, we had people volunteer doing, you know, some of these sketches are done by volunteers that came and worked with the team for those 2 days, Friday and Saturday, or Thursday and Friday. And people took photographs. I went out and took some photographs. I did a couple of graphic things. So they had a great group of volunteers that helped you know, really produce the presentation you're seeing tonight. You know, people did Photoshop and Illustrator and, you know, helped put this whole presentation together, a slideshow. So, yeah, if you want to volunteer, info@thecoreproject.org. We'd love to have more volunteers. And as we move forward, you know, we're now just trying to figure out how to move some of these things forward. But if you want to be involved in that process, let us know.
Thank you. And that's Paul Fritz, who has been an architect in Sebastopol, and he has been part of the core project. Anyway, let's go on with a very interesting one. This is the nature connections and the greening of Sebastopol.
Leslie set up a great segue for me, and so I'm going to try and capitalize on what she said and then set the stage for Steve, who will talk about bikes and pedestrians. I think one of the important things that she said is that you know what to do. And so as happy as we are to be visitors, we are visitors. And so what we're really doing is telling you about the observations that we've made in your community in a very short period of time. But nonetheless, they're serving as very general recommendations for how you can capitalize on the assets that you have in your city. And so what I want to talk about very briefly is nature. Which means you can't talk about nature very briefly, but I'm actually going to try and do it in a few minutes. And what I want to do is talk about it in a way that helps you think about it as a framework for how you can actually shape the city in the future as you move forward. All right, so what I first want to say is that, and I think it's very obvious to everybody, Sebastopol is a very rich city because you are set in a very rich landscape. And so this is the city in nature. And without going into a great amount of detail, this graphic simply shows you that you're actually surrounded by a very wide variety of cultivated and natural lands, whether we're looking at wetlands, stream corridors, floodplains, cultivated agricultural lands, patches of woodland. It's a little bit, it's not shaky on the north and the south, but you can see that there are opportunities both on the north and south to really reinforce and strengthen this green belt. So what I'm saying is this is a city that it is set in the landscape. And so the question is, how do you bring that landscape, how do you bring those wonderful natural and culturally cultivated resources into your city? How do you create nature in the city. And what we're suggesting is, it seems that there are two ways in which you can do it, and there are two levels that you can do it on. One is the streetscape level. This is a very simple graphic diagram that shows you that there are opportunities to create a simple system of neighborhood greenways, which can act as fingers in the city that connect existing parks, existing trails, existing quiet streets, and also can create the opportunity for identifying areas in the city which could be developed as additional parks or open space, especially in those parts of town that are underserved by those kinds of spaces. The second way, and I'll get to this in a minute, is individual lots, whether they're publicly owned or privately owned, whether they're commercial or residential. And what we're saying is that at these two scales, they're both actually in the public realm because they're visible to everybody. And it doesn't matter if you're a citizen or a visitor. This is the city that you see. So it's not just downtown, but it's all parts of the city. And we actually walked and rode around many parts of these neighborhoods. And so we're saying that there are wonderful opportunities at both the street scale and the individual lot scale to manifest this notion of nature in the city. Let's just talk on this diagram very briefly about what we mean by neighborhood greenway. This is just a diagram. It's generic. It's not a detailed design or anything, but it shows that actually in the Barlow, there really is an opportunity for north-south pedestrian corridors. You could technically, you could connect to the high school, which means that it would be easier for students to walk down from the school into the Barlow. And you actually, especially with amenable private property owners, connect all the way down to the Rodota Trail with simple corridor vegetation. And there are opportunities at both the north and the south ends to create pocket parks, usually these individual sites that we're really talking about. Here's a little bit closer, or a generic detail of what we're meaning. At this north end, you can see the barbecue. We're right behind the cinema. There's actually a gas line that perhaps has the potential in the future to be a pedestrian or a bike corridor. At the north ends, there are empty spaces that could simply be vegetated with trees and vegetation. What that does is it really marks that corridor. It tells people where they are, and it tells them where they're going, and it's also a very simple way to, again, bring nature into the city. The same at the south edge. Very simple trees will actually reinforce what's already been planted along McKinley, but again, these simple techniques using vegetation, using nature, really tell you where you are. So you're kind of meeting multiple objectives with things that you folks are actually already expert at, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Here's just a very quick section showing how vegetation, the use of nature, can really serve not only to soften your streetscape, but again, it's all of this wayfinding, using special plantings that are particularly amenable to urban woodlands. You folks are very knowledgeable about the plant palette that you use here. You understand water use and native species and things like that, so it would not be difficult to really have a collection of plants that might be amenable. Again, they identify trails and corridors that can be used for manifestation of ecological principles, and they just help build out the streetscape and reinforce this whole notion of nature in the city. Here's an example of what we're talking about for neighborhood greenways. This is a very, again, a very generic little site diagram of a green street. We have the boulevard has been turned into a bioswale, so ground plants are filtering water. We're using street trees to create an urban canopy, so both the ground plane and the vertical plane provide shade and also a pleasant appearance. We've created some curb bump outs, planted them with trees that narrows the street down, and it's also great wayfinding to tell people that they're either entering or leaving the greenway. So we actually rode around town and found some pretty interesting streets that Steve can talk to you about that might be amenable to this if the neighborhood is amenable. And of course, we're talking here at a street scale level, and so we're really talking about an interconnected system. We're not talking about streets that are independently located that don't connect up to anything. Here's just a very quick little section showing you how a bioswale is built and its relationship not only to cars and the street, how it narrows down the street, but the relationship that it also has to pedestrians. And I don't know if you guys, but if quirky is quirky, then that's about the quirkiest car I've ever seen. If we talk about the individual lot scale, what I'm really talking about are several things. The city is really lush, and if you come in as a visitor, and I'm a landscape architect and I'm also a master gardener, it's very rare to come into a small town like this and see as many beautiful gardens and yards and streets as you've seen. So I'm not complimenting you in an arrogant way. I'm complimenting you in a way that really acknowledges your expertise in horticulture. So at the individual lot and site scale, this could be a garden city. And this could be a way to really distinguish yourself from other cities in the valley. And it plays on that wonderful horticultural tradition that Luther Burbank started here. And then it also plays on your current expertise. So why not take advantage of that knowledge and reinforce this notion of civic horticulture? It's frankly, it's feasible, it's affordable. These projects don't have to be overwhelming. And so we think that there are like three places where this could happen. And one of them is empty spaces in the city, whether they're public or private. And we're not talking about ownership issues here. We're just saying that there are places in the city that could become vegetated, planted lots. They can become pocket parks, especially in those parts of the city that, again, as we mentioned, are underserved and don't have enough natural open space, or they're next to schools that don't necessarily have enough green space around them. It's just an example of a little corner lot that simply could have trees on it, perhaps benches, flowers. We're not talking about a complicated landscape design. Here's an example of a corner, again, corner unused lots, curb bump outs, very simple ways that you can plant up, and actually you've started to do that with crosswalks. They're great little examples of flowers and things that are in the crosswalks, but why not do that at corners to create reinforcement of the garden city? And it also protects the pedestrians from traffic, and it serves as a reinforcement for wayfinding, which Steve is going to talk about in a minute. Lush, incredible gardens in the city. These are just a couple of random photographs that we took in the last couple of days. I mean, look at the profusion of flowers. You're not only blessed with climate, but again, you're blessed with a lot of knowledge and a lot of interest in this particular subject. Here's an example of open space, but also continuous woodland between properties, which is something I'll just talk about in a minute. Again, ground landscaping and a pretty decent tree cover. So what we're saying that at an individual property level, there are many opportunities if you're interested for reinforcing that existing city landscape. And that means either planting in ways that connect into a greenway if it happens to be on your street, continuing the kind of planting that you do in your gardens, whether it's flowers or food, or you're planting for butterflies and things. I mean, you guys have garden tours up the Kazoo that, quite frankly, people in Seattle would die to come on, because even Seattle, which is considered the banana belt of the Northwest, does not have as extensive an opportunity for people to go visit gardens. So what we're suggesting is, why not reinforce that, work with your neighbors to create backyard habitat, neighbors that you like, of course, that you're neighbors without fences, but. And that just means simple things like clustering trees and shrubs to invite certain kinds of habitat in, or reinforcing your gardening techniques. Again, connecting to this streetscape that we're showing by using trees and shrubs that just blend into the bioswales. If you think about civic horticulture, it meets a lot of goals. We've read a lot of material about interest in being sustainable and interest in reinforcing your identity. So this whole notion of civic horticulture at both the streetscape and the individual lot scale would in a way solve that issue. It reinforces the history that you've come from and reinforces your current expertise and your interest in the city as a garden, but it also helps you focus this definition of sustainability, which Google says is one of the most undefined words in the entire internet. It gives you a focus on how do you green, how do you renature your city in a way that helps you develop resilience in the face of growing climate change, which is becoming increasingly hard to argue about, even in the face of growth, whatever other pressures are going to face Sebastopol in the future.
Well, yes, the greening of Sebastopol, very important.
Yeah, and it's also, as Chris was pointing out, that we're already a pretty green place. And if we can just sort of capitalize on that resource, and as we were discussing a little bit earlier, you know, it's something that is one of the things that, you know, having these out-of-towners come in to our community and point some of these obvious things out, but, you know, it's something I hadn't really considered before. You know, when I started walking around and looking at the neighborhoods in Sebastopol, and we do have some great green spaces and beautiful front yard gardens, and people are very interested in that here, I think. You know, a lot of people growing their own food on their properties and really taking pride in their yards. And if we can, I think this is one of the low-hanging fruits, so to speak, that came out of this process for me, is that if we can somehow find a way to capitalize that and make these sort of greenways to the town to help encourage pedestrian connectivity and people on bikes and giving them, you know, beautiful environments to walk through and bike through. That's something that's, you know, I think pretty achievable.
Well, that's it. I mean, what we're up to now, you know, is been leading up to the last two sections is bikes and pedestrians and transportation and traffic. And obviously that all then mixes in together as to the livability of our city.
Yeah, yeah. And I think most of us like the green space. I mean, we live in Sonoma County because we like the green space and the open space and the nature. And it's you know, not so hard to bring that nature into the city. And that provides links to, you know, when you come into Sebastopol from Santa Rosa on the Joe Rodota Trail, you just sort of get dumped on Petaluma Avenue.
Right.
You know, there's no place for you to go, especially if you're a visitor, you don't know where you're going. But if there was some link that took you from there to Ives Park, for example, you know, if there's some kind of greenway we could create there. And then from there, if there was some greenway that took you to Regal Park through town, you know, connecting these natural places outside of town through town to take us, you know, across town along a green pathway.
Yeah, so we don't have to create anything new. It's really just connecting up what we've got already.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're a long way there.
Yeah, it's not too much farther to put it all together.
Well, and that's it, you know, and parks. I know they talk about parklets. It's not just, we're not talking about Ives Park or Valentine's Park. We're talking about little teeny corner pocket parks as well as being important to neighborhoods.
Yes, exactly. You know, just a few benches here and there can really make a big difference. People walking down the street, running each other, have a seat and talk. And I think that's one of the things we all love about Sebastopol is the friendliness and running into people we know and being able to have those spontaneous conversations and helping to provide a little more infrastructure for that to happen.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I think during the discussion, there was, you know, talking about Main Street as obviously our main center of town, but people don't really hang out there.
No.
Because there's no really place to really hang out and hang out with people and talk in a comfortable way. So
Yeah, you run into someone you know on Main Street and the two of you are talking, you pretty much block the sidewalk.
Right.
You know, there's no room for anyone to get by you. So you don't often stay there for very long because it becomes an uncomfortable space, you know. So we need to work on that, something we really need to work on.
Yeah, I mean, in San Francisco, they have those lovely little parklets that go in one or two parking spots.
Yes.
And they have been incredibly successful.
Yeah, if we had something like that, you know, take a couple of parking spaces on Main Street and make a little parklet that you could have a conversation or put a couple chairs out or a bench in front of a cafe or something and encourage people to linger and hang out with each other. And that's, you know, we all love about this place.
Well, and that's it. And create that flow so you can go, you can get to Santa Rosa, you can get to the Laguna, you can get to Forestville. All those things would all be linked up with Sebastopol as the center, one day, I might say.
We're the hub of West County. Yeah, let's capitalize on that.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. Obviously, we're less than 8,000 people, but I think I heard the 40,000 was our basic market town.
Yeah, I've heard 40 to 50,000 is our market population. You know, if you think about, you know, between Sebastopol and the coast, there's actually a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always amazed driving those back roads.
Yep.
How densely the countryside is populated.
Yeah.
You know, yep. It's not as rural as we all imagine it to be. There are a lot of people that use Sebastopol as their marketplace. And, you know, we have to be able to accommodate all those people, you know, beyond our 8,000 population.
Exactly. And that's coming to us and passing through us.
Exactly.
Two different functions going on we're having to juggle in this plan, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's, you know, what I think the first presentation from Ken was talking about as being a crossroads town. You know, it's how we developed, and we still are a crossroads town at heart. But being able to work with that and don't let people just pass through that crossroads, but stay and linger and, you know, shop and dine and, you know, have fun in Sebastopol.
Just hang out,
yeah.
Well, that was interesting about, you know, just hanging out when they asked the school kids where the center of town was.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's the Safeway parking lot. Who knew?
You see them there a lot. Yeah. I've definitely run into a few high school kids in Safeway parking lot before. Yeah. Yeah, and that's maybe not the most exciting place for a high school kid to hang out, but, you know, we don't have a lot of other options, really.
Yeah, I mean, if the plaza, you know, again, it's improving the plaza, making it more walkable to get to it. It's all those factors that we really need to address now.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Well, shall we go on to bikes and recreation, bikes and pedestrians?
So we heard a lot about today from my colleagues about the region and getting around town, and we heard a lot from you in the last couple of days about walking and biking, and that's what I'm here to talk about. Anybody walk here tonight? Pretty good. Anybody ride a bike here tonight? A few of you. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So Ken showed us this image a little bit earlier, and one of the wonderful things that you've got going for you is the connections that you've got to Santa Rosa and to West County on the trails that are very walkable and bikeable, and hopefully a future collection south to Petaluma. One of the things that we pointed out, or that we discovered really, is that there are a bunch of great destinations very close by in downtown, and but we're also cut up, like we were saying earlier, by the highways. Well, it's only the whole city is within a 15-minute bike ride from the plaza, and actually a whole lot of the countryside is only 15 minutes away. 15 minutes is not very far. 15-minute walk is really almost all of the central part of the city. We're 15 minutes from the plaza where we are right now. It's just not a happy 15 minutes. So as far as bicycling goes, 5 to 6% of the population would love to ride a bike, and a little sliver of them will ride a bike no matter what. Out on that highway, in the rain, in the winter, they don't care. They'll be out there. Another slim percentage is interested, and they'll do it if there's a bike lane, even if there's major traffic there. There's a whole bunch of people, 30%, that just aren't going to ride a bike. Doesn't matter. You know, you could do whatever. And it's just, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't fit their lifestyle or their conditions. But there are like 60% that would ride a bike if, fill in the blank. And there's some things we can't do anything about. In Seattle, it's rain. We can't do anything about that. But you don't have to worry about it. In Seattle, it's hills, but you haven't got many hills. You've got some in this kind of southwest corner. But still, you've got great control over why people might walk or bike or not in the city. There's also a huge proportion, maybe 60%, 40 to 60% of the population that can't drive by themselves for whatever reason. They're too young, they're infirm, they haven't got a car for whatever reason, they choose to or just don't, and they either need to get a ride from somebody or walk, bike, or take transit. And so by improving circulation for people to walk and bike in the city, especially within this 15-minute walk shed of the plaza, is really an equity issue, too, to help make the city accessible for everybody. So let's zoom in a little bit and take a look at the plaza. The highway bikeways are there already, but none of you, very few of you, well, 1% of you, that's two in this room, will use that bikeway. Here's a whole bikeway network that we're looking at. The trails in purple and potential extensions, the Rialto Trail and the trail to Ives Park,
the bike lanes that the city's got. Actually, the city's got a great bike master plan that could use an update, even though it's fairly recent. And there's a bike lane feasibility study that's actually quite thorough. But there are some new guidelines that are becoming accepted across the country for different types of bike facilities that would really make the landscape, the whole city, much more accessible for people in that 60% that would, if only, it felt safe to them. And one way to do it is with neighborhood greenways. Neighborhood greenways are quiet streets that are out of traffic, that they're really the sort of street you want to live on because there aren't people roaring by. It's your neighbors that are coming and going at sort of normal pace, hopefully. And it's the kind of street that you'd say to your kid that's maybe even only 7 or 8, go play in the street because they're close by. You can watch them and you know that nothing's going to happen to them. Well, High Street and the extensions of it, north and south, makes great connections from Pinecrest Elementary School all the way to the high school. And I think there's a great possibility to have a parallel bikeway, pedestrian and bikeway, a neighborhood greenway there. And we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail, too. So the plaza is the center of the universe for Sebastopol. The Rialto corridor we talked about would make a great connection between the two signals that are there on Sebastopol Way and would connect in to the theater, which is up on the top, from the Redota Trail down here, right through, sneaking between some buildings and taking advantage of McKinley. It would be a lot like the trail, the existing trail that's a couple hundred feet further east that connects over to the east side of the Barlow. Also, this is a really, really important connector that really nobody needs to tell you about. From the end of the Redota Trail to Ives Park is incredibly important. So some sort of great pedestrian treatment. You've got several really good pedestrian signals in town now, and you just need a couple more there and there and some other places around the network. The High Street Neighborhood Greenway is a great opportunity to connect from way south, right at the edge of that 15-minute circle at Pinecrest Elementary, all the way north to the West Valley Trail, which connects into the high school. What a great opportunity for families and everybody to be able to get from Ives Park all the way north, but it doesn't get you downtown. But it gets you within a block of downtown. So here's how we get downtown then, by having really high order bike lanes, so buffered bike lanes on the highways, which is better than a bike lane because it gives you a little bit extra space, and a separated cycle track for the circuit around downtown. And we'll tell you how we're going to do that in a little bit. So cycle tracks are separated. So here's what the whole network in downtown looks like. Actually, we can get over to Broomhaven Park and down to Pinecrest School, over the Redota Trail, the Laguna, and up to the high school to connect into all those trails with a really great neighborhood greenway system and some the trails and a really high-order highway bikeway system. So here's what a cycle track looks like. And this is in a U.S. city. This is in Portland. It's protected by parking. So this is the parked car. The travel lanes are over on the other side of it. There's a little buffer, there's the bikeway, and there's a curb. It can be as simple as paint on the street, and these little bumper gizmos are braille so people don't, you know, park in there. It could have a shallow curb, or it could have a really bold curb. And this might even be flat between the bikeway and the sidewalk. That's feasible within your street system. This is what Main Street looks like downtown right now. And this is about the only place that people really are comfortable. Although I did see a kid about 14 years old on his way to school this morning riding in the street. Mom, did you know that he was riding in the street? So what if we turned it into a two-way street instead and had buffered bike lanes, still have parking because we need parking for the businesses downtown, cycle tracks, parking that's protecting them, and a lane of traffic in each direction.
Oh, yes, important one, bikes and pedestrians.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people are really looking for more of in Sebastopol. You know, I think Sebastopol is the only city in the county that doesn't have a single bike lane.
I never realized that.
There's
not a
single bike lane in Sebastopol. I think we're the only ones.
Whoa.
You know, for a place as progressive as Sebastopol, you know, that's not a great sign. So this is, yeah, this was a really interesting segment to think about, you know, what can we do in terms of creating this, you know, a better bicycle network through town and connecting again, making these connections to the existing bike system we have, you know, the West County Trail and the Joe Rodoto Trail are great resources. Oh. But again, once you get into town, you're kind of left to your own devices.
Right. That was it. 60% may get a bike if the right conditions prevail. Yeah. So that's a big low hanging fruit there if we can get to there.
Yeah. And I know the city does have a bike master plan. They do have a plan for bike routes, but so far it has not been implemented. You know, basically, you know, financial difficulty, you know, they don't have the money to implement it. But this is one of those things I wonder, you know, can you get a team of volunteers to do something? You know, how hard is it to paint a stripe on the road?
Right.
You know, so
put planters or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Things that
it
create
seems
barriers.
Like it's not that difficult that we could come together as a community and around an idea like this and make some bike lanes in town and help people get around.
Exactly. And again, it all goes down to walkability, bikeability in a crossroads town where there is no natural way of getting over, under, or through those main arteries.
Yeah, and we have to assert our right as pedestrians and bicyclists. You know, we have a right to be able to get around, too. It's not just about the cars.
Exactly.
But, you know, and we're going to hear, I think the next section is about transportation, but I think for far too long in this country, we've been catering our circulation networks to the car and forgetting about pedestrians and bikes. It's time to take our rightful place. You know,
indeed. Yes, indeed. I hope our city fathers are listening to that. It's it is vital for, obviously, for our children, for exercise. You know, if there's an easy, safe way to get around town, then people will do it and we'll get healthier. And there's all those intangible things that benefit us.
Yeah, definitely.
Bikes and pedestrians and nature connections, green connections for us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing they didn't mention, one of my favorite things is the daylighting of the creeks through town.
Mm-hmm.
Is very important greenwaying, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for nature, for bringing nature into town.
Yeah, there is potential for that. There are some definite, you know, creeks in some locations that, you know, have the opportunity to be opened up and exposed again, and, you know, be able to. Yeah, and make some different natural connections in the community.
Yes, transportation and traffic. That's everyone's favorite subject.
Yes.
How do we solve our crossroads situation and keep us a small, livable city? That's the key.
Yeah.
So let's hear this section. And then we'll get back a little bit of discussion. If you'd like to call at the end of that, 874-1073 or Arnold on Air. This is Cows Radio.
I'm going to be talking about transportation tonight. There's the city, and there's the big roads coming into town. There's two lanes on all of them, and they all go to one spot. And so we can call that the constraint. So you can deliver more traffic than that intersection can ever handle. There's one lane leaving here. No shortage of signs. One lane leaving on the other direction. So to me, I'm thinking maybe this could be a two-lane street. And that's what it looks like leaving at the other end. And then there's one lane east direction on the other street. So the rub, of course, is here at the constraint. And what happened in the past is somebody said, okay, to relieve this constraint, we're going to separate the through movements. And that created the one-way system, which has disadvantaged your city business-wise and otherwise ever since. So what we've heard is that there's no money for a bypass. There's no good location for a bypass. There's some potential for some network, which some of you shared with us. Our conclusions is that congestion isn't the choice. It's kind of a given, especially what's going on around. But how the city deals with the congestion is your choice. And that's what we really want to focus on. So there's two choices you have, basically. One is the traffic first approach, is what has happened historically. And this is where you maximize the throughput through your city at the expense of your quality of life, your safety, and your business community and your imagination of your downtown. The other choice is a city first approach, which I think is what we're feeling in the community, where you advance the community's vision in a sober, responsible way, cognizant of your crossroads history. And I think that's where I'm feeling the city wants to go. There's a few myths out there I just want to shatter before we begin the rest. One is about roundabouts. This is what a roundabout looks like. They're quite friendly to cyclists. They're very easy to cross as a pedestrian. We're using them near schools now. You just walk, you look to the left, walk to the Splitter Island, look to the right, walk across. It's quite easy to do. Quite safe. Crash rates go down tremendously. Injury deaths go down even more. Child literacy goes up about 50%. But roundabouts have a lot of good attributes to them. They can handle buses, fire trucks. They don't have to be round either. These are ovalabouts at interstate interchanges. This is a barbell type roundabout up in Colorado. There's some regular roundabouts on the four-lane arterial road. This is a peanut about. So they come in all kinds of shapes. I also want to talk a little bit about how, on a regional network basis, how some streets and intersections have biased the traffic to come downtown. So here's where you're starting, let's say, and you want to go someplace up here, and there's two choices of a route. And because of the way this is configured, you tend to go towards A. In this example, you tend to use the B route because you don't want to bother with the turn. But a roundabout, it kind of splits the loads more evenly. Once you're in the roundabout, it doesn't really matter which one you use, so it kind of distributes the loads better, and that will become important. Network, we've heard that some folks would like to close some of the streets in downtown, but you don't have enough network already, so keep all your streets. You're going to need them. It helps break up the land uses, and it provides multiple routing options, which is really important for the locals. You know, the through traffic follows the trailblazing signs, but you need routing options to get around on bike, by car, on foot, and so forth. A fine grain block structure also allows for easy walking. It's easy to cross a lot of little two-lane streets as opposed to crossing big streets. It's kind of like going up big stairs compared to little stairs. Mixing the land use is really important for vibrancy, so not just network, but bringing everything you need close at hand. And when you do that, you don't have to move around very much. So this is what we do in terms of travel. 80% of what we do doesn't involve work. So in your downtown, if you can concentrate entertainment and all this kind of stuff in close proximity, it will really help, and particularly if you mix up the work in there as well. This is a vibrant place a long time ago. This is Richmond, Virginia, like maybe, 1920 maybe? And the litmus test for all this is, does the change reward the short trip and or the transit trip? And look at that vibrancy, lots of stuff going on there. And this is Richmond, there's little trolley lines, and the whole place is walkable and accessible by transit until 1949, where they set aside those values and put forth a value set of rewarding the long trip and the car trip. If you go to that same street, this is what it looks like today. So they systematically change the design of the street to reward long trips. It's still a busy street, particularly in the peak hours and the rush hours, but you want short trips, because once you get the average trip length down, a lot of them become walking trips, and that's what we think about as vibrancy. So being a traffic engineer, I decided to model your city. And so here's my model. And so what we have is a bunch of streets coming into a constraint. It doesn't really help to keep them going quickly into the city. So those approaches coming in, I would even start choking them down a little bit, making them slower, because getting folks to the jam-up point quicker isn't helping anybody, let alone anybody living along these routes. And then I would do an entryway at the edge, letting people know they're in town, and I would actually change the design of the street, so it might look like a highway out here, but then once you go past the entranceway, you're on what looks and feels like a city street instead of a highway. And then you get sort of a balanced system. We heard folks about, well, we don't want density and mixes downtown because of traffic. Now, you could knock down all the buildings around the downtown, and you're still going to have problems at those intersections. That's not the issue. In fact, intensifying and mixing in your downtown will actually help, because those are lots of short trips. if you do this sort of thing, all you have is long trips, and they use up your car carrying capacity. It's not good value for your city. Here is Petaluma Street, and look at it. It looks like a highway. However, it's signed, and it says it's right around Forest, and so everyone goes slowly, right? Anyway, the street's saying go fast. The sign's going to say go slow. I'm saying maybe you should think about making the street self-enforce and make folks go slow. This is going the other direction on Main Street. You know, come on. So when you ever have more than one lane going in the same direction, people will weave and speed and so forth. And so a two-lane street, you go the speed of the guy in front of you. So it makes a lot of sense. And you got plenty of room for bikes and so forth. Now, look at the scale. Like, we're in a little place here. 8,000 people in the city or something and 40 in the area. Look at the size of the lanes and that. So it's saying, this is the out in the suburbs or in the rural area. This is what we call the transect. So this is urban, this is rural. So in an urban area, you expect lots of pedestrians, trees and grates, low-scale lighting, nice materials, slow speeds. In rural areas, you expect forest, you know, less quality materials, higher speeds. In the suburbs, you expect in between. And what you don't want to do is import suburban ideas and rural ideas into your city. So you've imported huge cobra heads and high speeds into your city in terms of design. And what you want is what we call a consistent design vocabulary in town. So, for example, at 116 in Maine, instead of looking like this, maybe it could look like this. And now the strategy in the past has been to separate the through movements. And the strategy is to remove the lefts so that this can be shrunk so you can easily cross short cycle lengths. And there's the protected bike lane. So you come down on your bike, you go through it like a kind of a conventional bike lane so everyone can see you, and then you go back to where it's friendly. So this half shows you'd be riding along, you come down, you go through the intersection. The other side shows what it would be typically along the side. And so you can stop at a shop or stop and park your bike. And so it's really quite comfortable to a huge population of potential cyclists. So here's the whole area. And if you look at the traffic volumes, it's like a big giant T-intersection. This one's a bit of a minor approach, but this is a huge T-intersection. And what we're thinking is if we could get some of the trips to not have to come downtown when they have no business in the city, it would really help the city. And so here's the real volumes, and the size of the dots are proportional to the volume. You can see these huge volumes coming down here to the constraint. Now, if we could use the existing regional road network with maybe a few tweaks, these little volumes can go up easily, and these green ones can go down and really help your downtown situation. But there's three areas which need to be addressed, and I want to thank Colin for helping me with this. We're going to look at this one first. So there's lots of ways to get around. So this is 7 miles through this way. This is 8. It's actually faster, even though it's just slightly further. But it needs a little connection built just to make it feasible. And then at the south end, this is what I was talking about. This intersection biases the traffic to force them to kind of come downtown when there's a perfectly good regional route up that way. And if it were a roundabout, folks would use either route. It would make a lot of sense. And then there's the other route. Again, faster and shorter in this case. But we've got this really peculiar interchange design where you have all the circuitous routing, so folks actually, you know, will come downtown because of that. And with a minor modification, you know, folks would have choices. And with a roundabout, even better, then they would be distributed without having to make a turn at an intersection. The other thing, entry features, you should announce to people that they're coming into town and to expect pedestrians and cyclists. And here's a good one in Germany. So you're in a rural area, you're coming into town, and notice how the edge treatments change. They got a couple little gateway signs. You get closer, the road gets narrower. And as you get into town, the section encourages you to go slower and slower. So I was going 60 miles an hour. By the time I got here, I was going 20 miles an hour without any signs or police or anything. And the street environment told me what speed to go. No curbs here, nice protected bike lane, parking, great little main street. This is your square. It's like a little island floating in an ocean of car stuff. And so I just want to introduce this. This is the University of Central Florida. It has 50,000 students, a big university, more than your whole regional population. And this is their main shopping street. And when we designed this street, we designed it with no curbs. And so there's the residences. So the students, and particularly the mobility impaired folks, can get around campus in an equitable, barrier-free way. This is Sulphur Springs, Texas. I just want to draw your attention to this square because it reminds me of your square, except this one's bigger. This one, miserable place. Well, yours isn't as miserable as this, but it was a miserable place with a nice building. It used to be a state, the state one-way state truck route went like this and then up the other way like that. And they have a parking lot like you do and then some space over here. So what we did is we two-wayed all the streets and we put the parking out of the middle onto the edges. And so now there's all kinds of events. People have rediscovered the square. They picnic there. They have their farmer's market. You know, a lot of social exchange going on. They have bands and the kids come out and go to the dance. And they've got July 4th. Everything goes on there. They have reenactments. And you have to bring your gun if you're in Texas, by the way. Now there's no curb. So when you're having big events, you can spill out into the street without tripping on the curbs. And then, of course, it added a lot of value to the area. And so this empty store redeveloped, and now there's a restaurant and some housing up top. You know, all kinds of shops opened up. And
Very interesting last segment, transportation and traffic. There was some very interesting information they pulled out.
Yeah, and that's always the big issue in Sebastopol, isn't it? The traffic. That's, you know, ask people what their concerns are about downtown Sebastopol, and that is probably the number one concern.
Yeah,
people have is the traffic, and I think Ian pointed out some very interesting ideas, and you know, kind of up to us. Are we providing our downtown for cars to move through as quickly as possible, or do we want a downtown that's based, you know, designed for people?
Right.
And you know, it's kind of our decision. And historically, we've been designing our downtown to move cars through as quickly as possible, even though the cars are getting jammed up. But,
right,
you know, the cars are getting jammed up now.
Like, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I mean, so if we design for people to walk and bike more comfortably and we get more people out of their cars, you know, maybe that makes the traffic better. And it just makes a better environment for those of us that want to walk around downtown.
Yeah, I suppose it's tricky when you have Caltrans as the authority, you know, coming through your town and they have the that authority.
Yeah.
I suppose everyone's just left them to it and have just ignored that whole corridor.
A little bit, but my understanding, I don't know the full history, but my understanding is the community actually was frustrated with traffic when it was a two-way street system, and they went through this whole, you know, what do we do with it, and came to this, oh, we'll make this one-way thing, and that's going to improve the traffic. And so I think the city actually worked with Caltrans to do that. It wasn't okay. Caltrans necessarily imposing it on us, and now here we are, and we've got this two-way street system that, you know, the streets feel like highways, and you know, we still have traffic,
right?
You know, so maybe we should go back to the, you know, more Main Street kind of feel. I mean, I live, you know, kind of down South High Street, and I walk down South Main all the time. And once people leave that intersection at Bodega, that's a straight shot. Yeah. Lanes are 14 feet wide. You can go pretty fast down there. And it feels like you're walking along a highway and not walking down a main street.
Very true. You know? Very true. It's very impersonal once it leaves. Yeah,
definitely. And so I think Ian had some really good points. You know, it's kind of our decision if we want to, you know, continue this focus on the cars or try to, you know, bring it back to the person.
Well, exactly, isn't it? Now that we've seen those two elements and that they can come together without getting injured.
Yeah, yeah. And it was interesting to look at, you know, a little bit outside of Sebastopol regionally and what kind of improvements could be made. And, you know, we have to work with the county and, again, Caltrans to make some of those other things happen possibly. But, you know, a few small changes could really improve the traffic situation in town by giving people some kind of alternatives if you're not wanting to come downtown, you're just wanting to pass through. You know, if we could look at, you know, ways to do that and decrease the traffic. But again, we are still a crossroads town. There's 40 to 50,000 people, you know, probably passing through Sebastopol every day that, right, you know, we need to recognize.
Yeah, we have to accommodate them as best we can, yet not suffer
for it. Yeah, exactly. And the way it is now, it's sort of trying to accommodate them, at the expense of the rest of us, and right. still we're in a traffic jam.
Well, it seems from the report, though, we have a lot of things to be optimistic about.
Yes.
I would say. I think some things have come up that really give some good solutions.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that they've really given us a lot to think about, and they'll be following up with a written report in a couple months that they will send us, and we can distribute as much as we want, and people can start really thinking about what do we want to prioritize and how are we going to get these things done.
Exactly, the low-hanging fruit that needs to be collected, basically.
Yes. You want to do that and keep our momentum going so we can reach for the more challenging solutions that they suggest, like the, you know, changing the street system. That's going to probably not happen in the next 6 months.
Right.
But, you know, if we start working on it, you know, maybe in 6 years or however long, you know, we might be able to make that happen and create a better environment for people downtown, and by doing that, you know, really increasing, you know, support for local businesses and making a vital, vibrant community.
Exactly, that keeping our town vibrant. And well, Paul, you know, you're an architect, and you work in Sebastopol.
Yes.
How do you see it? You know, how do you see just within your own realm as an architect the city?
You know, I think Sebastopol has great potential. You know, I love Sebastopol. I live in town and I can walk downtown and I love doing that. It's not always the best pedestrian environment, but, you know, I'm happy that I can do that. And I think there's things that we can do to support it and make it better. I would love to be able to go downtown Sebastopol in the evening, for example, mm-hmm. and do something or see someone, right. You know, sometimes I'll walk to Box Office Video and, you know, I'll hardly encounter a person in that, you know, 15 minute walk at 7 o'clock at night, which isn't all that late.
That's not true.
But, and some, you know, people talk about the traffic problem in Sebastopol, and sometimes I like to think of, I think we have a lack of traffic problem in some ways, you know, at certain times we could use some more traffic, you know, downtown, and not necessarily car traffic, but people traffic, you know.
Right.
You know, it'd be great to be able to go to a cafe at 7 o'clock at night.
It would, wouldn't it? I often yearn for that. Yeah.
But you can't. And you know, it's one of those things, you know, the chicken or the egg, which comes first? You need the people downtown, or you need the businesses to stay open, or, you know, who's going to come first, you know?
Exactly. Well, I suppose with the Barlow opening up, that's going to create a different dynamic in just a few months, really. We'll be seeing how that plays out.
Yeah, we will. And really, that connection down McKinley is going to be really important. And they talked about that several different times in the report, you know, really working on making that connection. And again, it's not far. There's this perception that it's far away because the old lumber yard almost is this real barrier to people's perception. But, you know, to walk from Main Street to the middle of the Barlow probably take you about 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that far.
I know. But again, the perception, there is a perception. It's a world away.
So, you know, really improving that linkage along McKinley is going to be vitally important in the next, you know, coming months.
Yeah,
for sure.
Excellent. Well, could you let us know about the CORE project again, how to get in contact with you, and so people can help?
Yeah, yeah. So if you want to be involved or volunteer or know how you can help, we have a mailing list, so you can send your email address to info@the-core-project.org, and we'll put you on our mailing list, and we send out, you know, we won't spam you, we don't send out emails that often, but, you know, we'll send out an email of how to be involved in the next steps when we figure out, you know, what those are going to be. And we're also looking for donations to continue on our work. We do need to raise some money to contribute to the ESTAT effort. We had to raise $5,000, and we're about there, I think. So we're doing pretty well. But then beyond, you know, we're going to, you know, need some funding to help move some of these ideas forward. So donations can be made as well. If you go to our SebastopolConnect.org website, that's our ESTAT website, there's a donate page there, and there's several different ways to donate, both online or sending a check in. And we appreciate all the support we've been getting, and we look forward to, you know, these next steps. It's gonna be exciting.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Paul, for coming in to help explain the presentation by the ASTAT crew, and really appreciate it. And let's hope that the Sebastopol's future is extremely bright.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And yeah, let's keep up this positive energy.
We will indeed. We'll keep focusing on it and keep it moving.
Great.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.